Hi all, this is Eric. So June's Journey is an engaging mystery game that takes place during the Roaring Twenties. June's on a quest to uncover a scandalous hidden family secret, and you are along to help. Search for hidden objects in a variety of Prohibition-era settings, chat and play with or against other players by joining a detective club. You'll even get the chance to play in a detective league to put your skills to the test and uncover a murder mystery along the way and customize your very own island estate as well. Whenever I'm in the middle of an especially sad or heavy book or stuck in an editing mess, I like to take little breaks and refresh myself with something light and fun. I enjoy testing my memory, attempting my best to keep it sharp, and I find this game handily does the trick. So, are you up for cracking the case? Discover your inner detective when you download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Welcome everyone to the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. While the new season hasn't officially started yet, I do have a couple of July episodes coming out to tide you over until August. Here's the first of the two, centered around one of the greatest and most infamous towns of the Old West. I'm so pleased to have as my guest Tom Clavin. He is a New York Times best-selling author, co-writing with Bob Drury, Salon's Best Book of the Year, The Heart of Everything That Is, The Untold Story of Red Cloud and American Legend. But today we're talking about his classic, Dodge City, Wyatt Earp, Bat Masterson, and the Wickedest Town in the American West. A thrilling read with a cast of remarkable characters, and so well written. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
So what inspired you to choose Dodge City, Kansas as a subject for your book?
Well, I came to it in kind of a loopy way. You mentioned The Heart of Everything That Is. That came out in 2013, and it was very successful, both in hardcover and in the paperback version. And initially, my writing partner on that book, Bob Drury, and I were looking for another story that would take us back to the American West in some capacity. And for some reason, one day, I was looking at information about Bat Masterson. And, a lot of people know who Bat Masterson is, or they know the name, but they don't know who he was. Was he a gunfighter? Was he a lawman? Was he a gambler? Was he whatever? He turned out to be all three. But as I got more interested in Bat Masterson, I found out that he and Wyatt Earp, when very young men, were best friends, and that they were both lawmen in Dodge City. And I didn't know that. I always thought I was a pretty good student of American history and of the American West. And I thought there was a good story in there, one that hadn't really been told. I mean, Wyatt Earp's story had been told, but 95% of it focuses on Tombstone and the gunfight at the OK Corral, and nothing is really known much about Wyatt's life up until that point. And that Bat Masterson was such a fascinating character. He wasn't just a supporting character as he's often portrayed, if he's portrayed at all. So anyway, I talked this over with Bob Drury, and we did suggest it to our publisher, and they actually wanted us to do a different story, a World War II story about this B-17 bomber crew, and that was what they were more interested in, and we ended up doing that book, which was called Lucky 666, and came out in 2016, but I still wanted to do the story, and I already had a track record as a solo author in addition to doing books with Bob Drury, so I said, well, I'm going to revise that a little bit and the original idea and really focus on Dodge City and just that period of time when Wyatt and Bat were the lawmen there. And so that's how it came about. It's you know, if you're lucky, sometimes something just drops in your lap, and this didn't quite drop in my lap, but it wasn't something I was specifically looking for. It did sort of evolve from an original idea.
You write in your intro, I believe, that you had two hurdles to climb in researching this book. First, there wasn't much at all out there about Bat Masterson. And secondly, there was too much about Wyatt Earp, right?
Right.
Can you talk about this difficulty and how you managed through it to write your book?
Well, there's been a lot written about Wyatt Earp. It doesn't mean that a lot of it is accurate. So that was one of the things I had to do for my own research is, the standard biography of Wyatt Earp is a book, is called Wyatt Earp by Casey Turfertiller, which is very, very good. If there's any drawback to the book, in general, is that it was published over 20 years ago, and, you know, over during that time, more information has been found and discovered about Wyatt Earp, so that's not in there. And specifically for me, a problem with the book is that, again, there's the Dodge City years are sort of glossed over. They don't get much space in an otherwise very comprehensive biography. So as far as Wyatt Earp, the good news is there's a lot that's out there on Wyatt Earp. The bad news is I really had to sift through it. And separate what the fabrications, the embellishments were from, and this was something even Wyatt himself caused a problem for him. I mean, he, towards the end of his life, when he could really use the money, people approached him about doing his biography or his autobiography, but they wanted to keep repeating these stories that were simply not true, or there was some kernel of truth in them, but then they went on in a different direction. So there was that, and then with Bat Masterson, the other side of the coin is that there really hasn't been a lot written about Bat Masterson. There was a book in the 1950s by, I think his name is Richard O'Connor, and a biography of Bat Masterson, that became the basis of the TV show that played in the late 50s, Bat Masterson, with Gene Barry playing the title role. But that's a good read. But again, there were things that turned out to be just simply not true about Bat Masterson's life that made it in there. And so the big advantage, though, thankfully, is that Bat really enjoyed writing. He even when he was a lawman, a supposed gunfighter, and a gambler, he would write letters to the editor of newspapers. You know, he was also politically active. He was very active in the Republican Party in Kansas, and you know, so he would write letters to the editor for candidates he was backing or causes he believed in. So you have years and years of him, you know, writing that being published in newspapers, and then later in his life, he wrote a collection of magazine pieces that were about people he had known, including Wyatt Earp and other people, Bill Thompson, others that were friends of his or rivals of his. Doc Holliday, he wrote a magazine piece on Doc Holliday, and then very much towards the end of his life, the last decade or more, he was actually working as a newspaper reporter in New York. So in Bat's case, even though there's not a lot written about him, he himself had written about himself, something that couldn't really be said about Wyatt Earp. So it was really combining the two, I sort of compare it to being a gold prospector. You spend your whole day sifting and sifting and sifting, and if you're lucky, at the end of the day, you end up with a gold nugget or two. And that was sort of the process for working on this book. You have to sift through a lot of the material, and at the end of the day, you can maybe find some good material that's reliable and you can corroborate.
So there are three main characters in this book: White Earp, Bat Masterson, and Dodge City, Kansas, right?
Right. Yeah.
Can you tell us some of the history of Dodge City and what role it played in the development of the Plains and Western expansion?
Well, Dodge City was the most, it became the most well-known and the biggest of the Kansas cow towns. What was happening in the late 1860s and early to mid-1870s is that the railroad was making its way west, and Kansas being situated in the middle of the country and being that almost direct route to Denver. So if you go between St. Louis and Denver, you did go through Kansas. And so the railroad was cutting across, and then you had, after the Civil War, you had these tens of thousands of cattle in Texas that the ranchers from as far south as the ranches on the Rio Grande River that they, you know, he needed to bring north to get them to market and sell them. And so the combination of, as the railroad's moving across, because Kansas, when you go across, when you leave Kansas, when you leave Texas and you're going north, you pass through, it's the Panhandle, you pass through what used to be called the Cherokee Strip, which is that thin northeast part of Oklahoma, and then you're in Kansas. So the best route for these ranchers was to bring their cattle almost due north, across the border into Kansas, and then be able to put them on a train and ship them to points east, north, and east, and with the slaughterhouses. And Dodge City, as the railroad kept moving west, there would be these booming Kansas cow towns. There'd be, you know, Abilene and Ellsworth and a couple other places. But the best situated was Dodge City because it was in that southwest corner of Kansas, the closest one, of any of the cow towns, it was the closest one to Texas. So a big reason why being close to the, you know, cutting some time off the trail drives is that every mile that a cattle drive went, those cattle were losing weight. And so, you know, if they lost too much weight, it's costing you literally every mile and every pound that they lose is costing a rancher money. So to be able to go right across the border into Kansas and be at Dodge City where the railroad was an enormous benefit to the Texas cattle ranchers. And it became an enormous benefit to Dodge City because almost overnight you had all the saloons and the shops and the bordellos and, you know, all these other places of entertainment and services provided to the cowboys when they arrived in Dodge City at the end of the trail. The money was just flowing, Kansas, the Dodge City became, you know, the violence was there, the prostitution was there, the gambling, any number of vices were being practiced in Dodge City in the early and mid 1870s, and that's why, you know, people elsewhere, you know, newspapers as far as San Francisco, San Diego, New York, Chicago, they were referring to Dodge City as the wickedest town in the American West. That's the terrible reputation that it had. And, the Dodge City business community was willing to tolerate that as long as the money kept flowing in. But they sort of didn't quite understand that the Texas, that the ranchers, the cattle barons were saying, you know what, I might want to take my cattle elsewhere because I'm hiring these guys, these cowboys, to get up there to bring the, and I want them to come back for the next trail drive, but they're killing each other because there's guns and there's alcohol and there's women and, a combination that leads to people killing each other, literally in the saloons and in the streets. So that's the reputation that Dodge City had. And so not only does Dodge City significant in the story of the American West because of that reputation, it was like it was the ultimate of boom towns in the 1870s. But it also became significant because if you could turn Dodge City into a civilized place, then that held out hope for the entire frontier.
Towards the beginning of your book, you include a period photograph of Dodge City, and it looks incredibly desolate, surrounded by vast flat plains. It must have been quite an oasis, though, like you said, to cowboys riding in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as I mentioned in the book, when you went west past the Missouri River and you were heading to into Kansas and eventually Nebraska and the Dakotas, I mean, the name that was given to in the early 1800s and getting into the mid 1800s is still being called. That part of the country was called the Great American Desert. It was now part. It wasn't literally a desert like the Mojave or something like that, but it was just a. It was hundreds of miles of basically flat land. You can go for long stretches without rainfall some times of year. So, if for those who haven't been to Southwest Kansas, for example, where Dodge City is located, it's a bit hilly, but it's mostly flat, and it is you have long stretches of unoccupied land, and so it's Dodge City was the only reason why Dodge City existed. I mean, a lot of people would not necessarily may have chosen that as a place to start a town, but the reason why it existed is because there was a military fort there, Fort Dodge, and the commander there was having a problem with too many of his soldiers showing up for roll call drunk, and so he banned alcohol from the fort, and the soldiers still wanted to drink, they just couldn't do it at the fort. So a couple of entrepreneurs, put up this sod house and put in a couple of kegs of whiskey, and that's how Dodge City's humble origins were began with a single saloon.
And what were the Indian tribes in the area during the time that Fort Dodge was established?
Well, there was actually a Kansas Indian tribe. There was an Omaha tribe. There were Cheyenne. I don't think the Comanche didn't come that far north. They stuck mostly to Texas area and that part of the country. There were some Sioux, although they were mostly concentrated in the Dakotas and Wyoming. So of the well-known tribes, probably Cheyenne were the most well-known.
So I'd like to ask you about Wyatt Earp's early life and the pivotal moments that shaped him into ultimately becoming a lawman.
Wyatt had sort of a meandering upbringing. His father, who eventually with two wives had, I think, 10 kids, traveled around a lot. And Wyatt was not – his early life, when he was in his teens and his 20s, he actually would get into some trouble, especially he had gotten married when he was, I think, only 20 or 21, and his wife was pregnant, and he was living in Lamar, Missouri, where he had family there. And he was working as a constable, and it seemed like this was going to be his life was pretty much cut out for him. This is what I'm going to do. And his wife passed and died. It's not exactly sure why. It could have been cholera. And the baby, who was, I think she was about like 7 or 8 months pregnant, did not survive. So Wyatt was racked by this terrible grief. And because of that, he wasn't a drinker, Wyatt was not somebody, he couldn't tolerate alcohol, but he was driven by grief to get into trouble, and he was even captured and imprisoned for being a horse thief, so Wyatt's life was not necessarily going in the direction that he would become probably the most famous lawman of the American West, but he found some redemption in Wichita. He had moved there because he had a brother and his wife were operating a business. I mean, it was a bordello, but it was a business, and it was doing well. And they invited Wyatt to come, and he could work there, and he could be a bouncer at the bordello, and he could do some other jobs. And the marshal there sort of got to know him and thought, well, this seems like a cool-headed person, and actually made him a deputy. And Wyatt started to get these notices, and even in the local press, about what a good job he's doing. And that was a redemption for Wyatt. He started to think about, maybe I could be a solid citizen. Maybe I can have a good life, as a lawman. Now, that being a lawman was not, today, somebody might aspire to be a police officer, and you can have a good career as a police officer with a good salary and benefits and things like that. Being a lawman in the 1870s was not necessarily a sought after job. You don't have your lifespan is jeopardized. But for Wyatt, he didn't see it necessarily as where I'm going to make a killing being a lawman, but I have a chance to maybe redeem myself as a person. So that when he started to acquire a good reputation, and then when the telegram came from Dodge City inviting him to move there, and because they were starting up basically a police force in Dodge City. He saw that as the next move for him, And he was still a young man. He was still in his 20s, and he was still evolving as a person. And Dodge City was played a significant role in his life.
Many people who have a casual knowledge of Wyatt Earp probably know him best from the film Tombstone,
yes,
where he and his two brothers, Morgan and Virgil, are prominent characters. He had more brothers than that, though, right?
He had five, I believe, altogether. Yeah, five brothers. Morgan, Virgil, Warren. I think there was James. There's at least one other one that I'm leaving out.
Was his name Newton?
Newton, yes, that was another one. Because his father had married with his first wife. He had a couple of children, a son and a daughter, if I remember correctly. And then his wife passed away, and it was with his second wife that he had a whole passel of more kids, including Wyatt and Virgil and Warren and Morgan.
And he was especially close to Virgil, wasn't he?
He was. Of all the brothers, it was a different relationship with different brothers. With Virgil, Virgil was the next oldest to him. And Virgil was the one that took him along when Virgil first went out west to become a freight hauler and stagecoach driver and took him under his wing. And so, he would always be very close to Virgil. But he was also close to Morgan because Morgan was the next one after Wyatt to be born. And so he felt kind of protective of his younger brother. And, as the film Tombstone portrays, one of the events that took place, and it was after the gunfight, the OK Corral in Tombstone, was that his brother Morgan was murdered. And that really put Wyatt into a rage. And because not only is the grief of losing a brother, but this was somebody who he sort of felt like he was supposed to protect, and then he didn't.
Did you find that movie historically accurate? Did it portray that history fairly well?
Well, I did, although I have to put an asterisk on that, in that I had not to that point done a lot of research into the events in Tombstone. I had to do some research into Tombstone because in Dodge City, I do talk about with both Wyatt and Bat Masterson what the rest of their lives were like, and you can't do that with Wyatt Earp without having some discussion of the events of Tombstone and the OK Corral and the death of Morgan and the shooting of Virgil. But of the pictures that I've seen, it does seem like that version, the movie actually called Tombstone, is the most accurate. And you look at some of the other portrayals of Wyatt, and again, they're almost all with Wyatt Earp in Tombstone. It's not Dodge City. But you go back to My Darling Clementine, the John Ford movie, where Henry Fonda plays Wyatt Earp. And in that one, you have Virgil, who is Wyatt's younger brother, not his older brother, and he dies before the OK Corral even begins. And Doc Holliday dies during the gunfight at the OK Corral, neither of which is accurate, is true. Gunfight at the OK Corral is the name of a movie with Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas, which again is fast and loose with the facts. So if your listeners are saying, gee, what's the best representation out there of Tombstone, I would suggest the film actually called Tombstone. There was another one that came out like the same year or the year later called Wyatt Earp with Kevin Costner playing Wyatt Earp. And it's good. I don't want to say it's worth watching, but I think the Kurt Russell one, a big reason why the Kurt Russell portrayal of Wyatt Earp and that film is so good is because of Val Kilmer and how he plays Doc Holliday. Doc was a sick man, putting aside the psychological part of it, but physically he was a very sick man. And when you watch Val Kilmer during that movie, he's sweating. And he looks like the actor is doing such a good job. You wonder how he made it through the rest of shooting the picture. So it's really well done.
So I'd like to switch over to Bat Masterson, if we might. You have some fascinating stories in your book about him. He came to Dodge City pretty early, didn't he?
He did. He came earlier than Wyatt did because Bat's family had settled. They were farmers, and Bat's family had settled in, I think it was about 12 miles north of Wichita, and had a farm there. So he was already, in Kansas, and he had very early on, he and his brother Ed, his brother was about a year, 18 months older than him, and they left the homestead to go buffalo hunting. And so they, at that time, in the late 1860s and early 1870s, You know, there were millions and millions of buffalo in Kansas. Eventually, they got almost completely eradicated because of the overkill. But you could, as a young man, you could make, it was very hard work and not very pleasant work at all, but you could make a pretty decent living as a buffalo hunter. So that's what Bat and his brother Ed did. And Dodge City was one of the places that buffalo hunters came with their you know, hides and buffalo meat and buffalo tongues, which were a delicacy for a while. And so so Bat was used to going to Dodge City, and as a young man, and he enjoyed the saloons. He was not a drunk by any means, but he enjoyed having a drink. And unlike Wyatt Earp, he could enjoy alcohol. Wyatt was Wyatt's constitution, or whatever you want to call it, metabolism, he couldn't tolerate alcohol. So he was never a drinker. Bat liked the saloon life. He was an outgoing, gregarious guy. He liked to be bending the elbow and then bellying up to the bar and talking to people there. He had a jovial personality for the most part. And people liked Bat right away. And he and Wyatt became best friends, but they were very different. You know, it was sort of like an opposites attract kind of thing. Wyatt was a man of few words, kind of aloof and distant, and didn't really trust people. He trusted Bat very much, though, and that's, I think, they one of the things that made them effective lawmen in Dodge City is they basically had each other's back, and they looked out for each other.
Speaking of that relationship between them, which is such an interesting part of this book, how did they first meet? I mean, they were on their own paths, of course, but their paths often intersected.
They did. I mean, they took different paths to meet up in Dodge City. And actually, they had met as buffalo hunters. You know, there's some dispute as to whether Wyatt Earp spent any time buffalo hunting at all. But it was a pretty common practice for a young man on the prairie in those days to try his hand at buffalo hunting because the financial rewards could be so good. And Bat, and, you know, he did write about himself. Bat himself wrote that that's when he first met Wyatt Earp. Bat was, I think, still a teenager, and he was on buffalo hunting, and he for some crossed paths with Wyatt on the, you know, the buffalo camps. So that's when they first met. They again went their separate ways, and what had happened was when after Wyatt had taken a job in Dodge City as a deputy marshal, Bat came to Dodge City by way of Texas. And what had happened was that Bat had some adventures as an Army scout. And after he was on the trail for a while, he wanted to just relax in this place called Mobidi, Texas, and just gamble for a bit and unwind. And he fell in love with this young woman who worked at a saloon there. And, you know, it really seemed like it was a serious thing for both of them. But the bad part was that there was an Army sergeant in the fort right there who was rather jealous. He thought that this saloon girl named Molly was his. And one night, he confronted Bat and Molly in a saloon, and he shot Bat and killed Molly. And Bat, you know, on his way down to the floor, got his gun out and shot and killed the Army sergeant. But Bat was very badly wounded. It was a kind of a miracle that he survived it all. And after he could travel, he went back to the family farm to recuperate further, and he came to Dodge City. One of his brothers, I can't remember if it was Jim or Ed, by that point was a bartender in Dodge City, and he said, "Well, I think I'll go to Dodge City and visit with so and so." And when he got to Dodge City, there was his old friend Wyatt Earp as a deputy marshal there. Wyatt was looking to basically Wyatt had a help wanted sign on the marshal's office. And Bat said, "Okay, well, you know, I'm not doing anything. I'll take the job." So Wyatt was the deputy marshal, and Bat sort of became Wyatt's deputy. So they hear these two friends, and they remembered how much they had hit it off with each other when they first got to know each other as buffalo hunters, and then being reunited in Dodge City was really what solidified a friendship that, according to Bat, lasted for the rest of their lives.
You mentioned earlier when you were talking about Bat Masterson, you called him a supposed gunslinger.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that a little? Is there some mythology about him being more of a legendary gunfighter than he really was?
Well, usually Bat is considered a gunfighter. You know, he's a lot of times, if there's a book on gunfighting or gunfighters or gunslingers or whatever, many times Bat Masterson is mentioned. And yet when you look at his life, he's responsible for maybe, well, we know of three men in particular he gunned down. But oftentimes they'll, you know, Bat was even described in newspapers as the blood on his hands and as a merciless killer. And, you know, it's just a reputation built up around him. It was kind of nice to have it in the sense that, you know, people would think twice about messing with him. And it became, you know, easier to maybe keep the peace if somebody says, oh, my God, I'm not going to draw on the great gunslinger, Bat Masterson. But it became a burden as the years went on. In fact, when Bat turned 50, when he was a lawman in the Dakotas, he had befriended a young fellow from New York who was trying to make it as a rancher by the name of Theodore Roosevelt. And that's the way Bat was. Bat befriended people, and people liked Bat. And when he made a friendship, it was a friendship that endured for a long period of time. And his friendship with Theodore Roosevelt endured for a long period of time. And when Bat turned in 1903, Bat turned 50, and he wrote a letter to the president, then President Roosevelt, saying, you know, I'm a little worried about my future because, you know, I have this reputation about being a quick draw gunfighter, and some young guy is going to come along and challenge me, thinking that, you know, killing off a guy with this reputation is going to give him a reputation. And that's when Roosevelt actually invited Bat. He said, well, why don't you come to New York? I'll make you the deputy U.S. Marshal for New York and get out of the West altogether, which Bat did. And that's a whole started a whole different chapter in his life. But there is a story in the book when Bat was in his later years, and there had been articles over the years about how many people he killed and total fabrications of gunfights that he had, things like that, dime store novels in which his various adventures are portrayed that never took place. And what can you do about it? It's like if something goes on the internet now, you can't stop it. It's out there. You might as well just grin and bear it. Bat would enjoy when he was in the later years working as a newspaper, and at the end of the day, he would often finish his night at a saloon. His favorite saloon was on Broadway and 44th in New York. And he always carried with him, and people knew that he carried with him a gun that had the 22 notches on it, representing each one of the outlaws he gunned down. Now, Bat did not gunned down 22 outlaws, but it was a prop, you know, and it was one of the stories about him, and he enjoyed the notoriety. And there'd always be at some point some roof man of town would, you know, come to the saloon, and there's the legendary Bat Masterson holding forth with whatever story he's telling, and the person would say, let me buy your gun. Just think, if I go back to Indiana or Nebraska or Maryland or wherever I came from, and I actually got the gun that tamed the West, you know, I'll be a big hero, and won't I be a celebrity? And Bat would keep saying no, no, no. But then when the price got to a certain point, Bat would say, okay, you know, I'll sell it to you, but you have to immediately leave town because, you know, I've said no to everybody else. If the word gets around that I said yes to you, we're both going to be in a lot of trouble. So the guy would pay the money, he'd go to the train station, boom, he's out, he's gone. And the next day, Bat would go to his favorite pawn shop and buy another gun and put 22 notches in it and stick it in his holster, and he's good to go.
There's some debate about how Bat Masterson got his nickname Bat, right?
Yeah, a lot. I think the common perception or belief is that he, you know, which stems from the television show, which had, again, this actor named Gene Barry portrayed Bat Masterson wearing a bowler hat and carrying a cane, and he could use the cane as a weapon. You know, he could bat people over the head, and they thought that's why I got the name Bat. And there were a couple other fabrications about his nickname, but it was actually kind of simple. He was born Bartholomew. That's his actual legal name, is Bartholomew Masterson. And Bat was the second oldest of, I think, seven children. seven or eight children, and his younger siblings could not pronounce Bartholomew. So they just used the first three letters. So he, from being a child to the rest of his life, because of what his siblings would call him, he was known as Bat.
And he, despite this incredible friendship with Wyatt Earp, he didn't get along with Earp's other great friend, Doc Holliday, did he?
No, and it wasn't Bat who can't really fault Bat, because very few people, well, no one liked Doc Holliday. He was really an unsavory character. He was drunk most of the time. He was belligerent. He was a killer. He apparently had not really a sense of humor. He didn't do much else but gamble and drink. And so for Bat, there was nothing there to form any kind of friendly relationship. Bat was somebody, he gambled too, but he liked to have fun doing it. He liked to tell jokes, tell stories, and he knew how to hold his liquor, which is not the case with Doc. But Bat was okay with Doc. I mean, they got along with each other because of, Bat acknowledged and recognized that there was a really strong friendship between Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday, and Bat didn't want to come between that or cause any problem for either man. So he was always, he's always got along well with Doc. In fact, there's even a story in the book about an adventure that without Wyatt that Doc and Bat went on, some kind of a railroad dispute that they both got involved in, taking sides for one railroad against the other, that ended up becoming a battle. And that was Doc. And then there was another episode in the book where Doc got into trouble in Colorado, I think it was. And Bat was the one that went up there and got Doc, extricated him from that and brought him back to Kansas. So Doc got along with Bat well enough because they both were great friends with Wyatt.
Part of what is so wild about this world of the old Western gunfighters is the small kind of tight circles that they ran in. And others that you write about in the book include Wild Bill Hickok, John Wesley Hardin, Ben Thompson. And these men often interacted with each other, didn't they?
Yeah, the James brothers, Belle Starr, the queen of outlaws. And it is interesting when you consider how large the territory was and how rudimentary the transportation was at the time, yet it still in some ways is a small world because their paths crossed. I think that was a big reason why Dodge City ended up being, like you said earlier, the third main character of the book, because Dodge City was a crossroads, was a place where people came. If you were going someplace else to the west, a lot of times you pass through Dodge City because the railroad was there, because it was a place that was good for gambling. It was a place that was good. You could stay there. You could take a bath there. You could go to a saloon there. You could actually see a show. I mean, there's a story in the book about how one of the dance hall entrepreneurs there imported this group of French dancers who were just introducing the can-can to America. In some ways, Dodge City became rather a sophisticated place, especially as the violence was reduced. It could become more, I guess the word is, civilized. But Dodge City was the third main character in the book because it did attract all these people that were both lawmen, outlaws, prospectors, hunters, trappers, business people, and people just not knowing what they were going to do. But, the Dodge City was a place on the map they wanted to come to.
So the same question I asked earlier about Bat Masterson, I want to ask about Wyatt Earp too. Is he the great gunfighter portrayed in film and TV? Does the legend equal the man? Did people during his time see him as the legendary figure that we know him to be today?
Not in the Dodge City years. I mean, it was the gunfight at the OK Corral and how that became, this pivotal action in the history of the American West. That was what made Wyatt Earp mainly his reputation. Now, during his Dodge City years, he acquired a reputation for being a really good lawman and a cool under pressure and kind of a fearless guy. But it was like he had some minor celebrity, if you want to call it. The gunfight at the OK Corral and in the decades after that, is when the wider myth just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And he was, you know, Wyatt Earp was never a gunfighter. You know, he wasn't somebody that would come into town and, you know, you square off against each other and he'd outdraw somebody. That just wasn't who he was. He had ways that if it was an outlaw, he could subdue people. He was a really good fighter, a boxer physically, and kind of an imposing guy and a strong guy, even though he wasn't a big guy. And so during his Dodge City years as a lawman there, he may have been responsible. I mean, you could say maybe, you know, he killed one guy. There was a cowboy who was shooting up the town, and as he was riding out of Dodge City, there were several Wyatt and Jim Masterson, Bat's younger brother, were firing after him, and it was believed that Wyatt's bullet wounded the man, and he fell off his horse, and they arrested him. And eventually, because of the wound in his shoulder, this guy contracted gangrene and died. So that's really the only death attributed to Wyatt Earp during his Dodge City years. Gunfight at the OK Corral, of course, you have, I think three of the four or five guys that faced off against the Earps were killed in that gunfight. So you could say that Wyatt Earp, you know, participated in that. And the other thing that often gets overlooked is that months after the gunfight at the OK Corral, that Virgil was ambushed and crippled by gunfire. And then Morgan and Wyatt were playing pool one night the following March when Morgan was ambushed and shot and killed. And that prompted Wyatt and Doc Holliday and another brother, Warren Earp, and a couple other guys to go off on what's been called the Earp Vendetta Ride. He tracked down, you know, the guys who shot his brothers, and several of them ended up dead. And so that was really where you get the perception of Wyatt Earp as a stone killer, but not for all his previous years as a lawman. And then he never was a lawman after that. You know, once that act was done, once he avenged his brothers, he never put a badge on after that. So he spent the next, you know, 40 years of his life not wearing a badge.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
One particular argument, he ended up dislocating Ava's jaw. Ava, she was such a tough cookie. Rather than cry or scream or anything like that,
Or call the police.
She should have, exactly. What does she do? She takes an ashtray and she knocks him over the head and knocks him unconscious. That's how she fought back. She didn't know what to do, so she called Louis B. Mayer. I think I've killed Howard Hughes. What do I do?
Revisit a time when the pictures were still big and everyone was ready for their close-up. When you want Tyrone Power instead of Tom Hardy, Jennifer Jones instead of Jennifer Lawrence, or Robert Mitchum rather than Robert Pattinson, then From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an eight-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day, 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
So after he left Dodge City, how long did it take him to get to Tombstone?
He moved to Tombstone, I believe it was either 18... He was in Dodge City for the most part from 1875 to 1879. And then he started to head to Arizona because Virgil was there. And and it took him a while. He manned it around. He was with his third wife at the time. So it wasn't until either, I can't remember now, the end of 79 or in early 1880 that he started to set some roots down at Tombstone.
So I'd like to go back to Dodge City again and to Boot Hill specifically. I remember going there as a kid and just being enthralled by it.
Yeah.
Why was it called Boot Hill and why has it become such an iconic American cemetery?
Yeah, not only that, but so many towns in the West have their cemeteries are called Boot Hill. But you know, supposedly Dodge City had the original Boot Hill, in that there was a little hill that overlooked Dodge City, and you know, this was before any real attempt at law enforcing was done in Dodge City. But you had a couple of cowboys up there, I guess, you know, taking a look down at the town, and they were drinking, and as can sometimes happen, a dispute broke out between the two of them, and one shot and killed the other, and basically just stretched him out there with his boots pointing at the sky, and you know, the body was discovered the next morning, and they just dug a hole and you know, pushed him into it with his boots pointed up, and for some reason it got the name Boot Hill based on that one event, and so it's sort of like without any urban planning, it became the town cemetery. And so as there'd be another victim of violence in Dodge City, they'd, you know, drag him up the hill and dig another grave and throw him in it, and Boot Hill started to become a popular place.
So your book opens with Bat Masterson arriving in Dodge City and being greeted by his old friend Wyatt Earp, and eventually they'd both play parts in what is known in history as the Dodge City War.
Right.
Could you talk about the origins of this conflict, how it escalated, and the roles that Earp and Masterson played in it?
Yeah, when Bat and Wyatt left Dodge City, they didn't leave exactly the same time, but they both basically left in 1879, and because their job was done, you know, Dodge City was a much more peaceful place for people to live, and they wanted to go on to other things. In Wyatt's case, he wanted to rejoin Virgil in Arizona. They hadn't seen each other for a few years, and in the case of Bat, he was restless. He wanted to, you know, just move on and see what's go up to he heard about, what about, I'll go to Deadwood, I'll go to Laramie, I'll go to Cheyenne, I'll go to some one of these other places and see what life is like there. And so they went their separate ways, and what happened was that a few years later, in 1883, a new government, you know, government came in Dodge City, and they basically wanted to return Dodge City to the way it had been when it was the wickedest town in the American West. And, you know, because there was a way to get the profits were, and they wanted to make more money, and things had gotten too tame. They were too quiet in Dodge City. It was threatened to become boring. And as part of that effort, there was a good friend of both Wyatt and Bats, Luke Short, and Luke owned a saloon and gambling house there. They shut him down. and actually, you know, threatened his life. And Luke sent telegrams out to Bat and Wyatt saying, "I need help. Here's what's happening in Dodge City. Can you guys come back and straighten things out again?" They're threatening to undo everything you guys had spent years and risked your lives to do. And so that's basically what happened. I think Bat might have been in Colorado, and he came to Kansas, and Wyatt was located, and he was in Kansas City, and they were putting together this group of ex-lawmen and friends who were going to go into Dodge City, and if necessary, they were going to take over the government. And that's what the newspapers were reporting on, this buildup. It's sort of like a Desert Storm. You know, there was this buildup of guys with guns, and Wyatt and some of his colleagues were the first to get to Dodge City. And where the book begins is in June of 1883, when Bat's train arrives in Dodge City, and he gets off the train, and he's got his guns and his shotgun and everything, and he greets Wyatt, and Wyatt and the others are there, and they're well armed, and they're going to. If the Dodge City War was what the newspapers called the Wyatt and Bat were back in town, and they were going to set things right the way that they had left Dodge City years earlier.
So a little bit about Luke Short, if you don't mind. He owned a place called the Long Branch Saloon. Right?
Yes, yeah. He owned a few saloons. He was a entrepreneurial kind of guy that he also had a hair trigger temper, and sometimes he kept getting himself into trouble. But so you know, he had pieces of several pies in Dodge City.
And he was a little bit shorter than the other guys, just like his name, right?
He was, you know, it's funny how things work out that way, but you know, he was a below average height, and so he appeared short, because you got to remember too, in the 1870s, you know, nowadays, maybe the average height is, I don't know what, maybe 6 foot tall for a male, 5'11", whatever. But in the mid-1870s, it was probably 5'5", or 5'6", and he was not even that tall. So, you know, maybe that was a big reason why he had a hair trigger temper, because, you know, his name was Short, and people were always remarking that he was short.
He was pretty quick with a gun, though, too, wasn't he?
Yes. Yeah, there's an episode in the book that involves Bat Masterson where Short kills a guy, and Bat tried to prevent it. It was just a little bit too late because, you know, Short whipped his gun right out and just shot the guy dead. And the Storms, I think his name was Charlie Storms, and that wasn't the only person that Short killed. But he was otherwise a good friend to Wyatt and Bat. You know, it's one of the interesting things about the book, I think, and about Dodge City and the frontier at that time, is you had a number of people who, at any given time, were on one side of the law or the other. You could have somebody who was a deputy marshal in one town, and a year later, you know, he and a gang of guys are robbing a bank. You know, and then the year after that, he's the deputy sheriff in a county in Nebraska. So, you know, because it wasn't like there were people lined up to take the job of lawman. So if somebody was happening to be on a good streak of being on the right side of the law and you needed somebody, you put a badge on.
Could you talk a little bit about Wild Bill Hickok?
Well, Hickok, you know, I mentioned Hickok in the book because he was by the time that Bat and Wyatt were in Dodge City and sort of figuring out how to be lawmen, Wild Bill Hickok was the prototype of the frontier lawman from two stints as a lawman, first in Hays City, Kansas, and then in Abilene, Kansas, especially Abilene, which is where he was more well-known for having been a two-gun lawman. And but by the time that, Wild Bill died in 1876 in Deadwood, and basically when Bat and Wyatt were both in Dodge City. So there are some books in O'Connor's Bat Masterson biography from the 1950s, you know, even has Bat Masterson, you know, participating in shooting contests with Wild Bill Hickok, like in Kansas City in like 1869 or 70. Well, while Bill might have been there, Bat was still a teenager. He wasn't in any shooting contest. Nobody would have cared who Bat Masterson was at that particular time. So I doubt that Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson ever actually met Wild Bill Hickok, because they were still only in their 20s when Wild Bill died.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So there is a pretty famous photograph of Luke Short, Masterson, and Earp.
That's the Dodge City Peace Commission. Yeah, that was taken in Dodge City in June of 1883 when these guys all got to town for the Dodge City War, and they either called themselves or were called or were labeled the Dodge City Peace Commission, but a little tongue-in-cheek, because they were all carrying shotguns and Colt pistols and Bowie knives and Derringers, and you know, they were armed to the teeth to take over the town, the city government, if they had to. But they were called the Dodge City Peace Commission, and there is a very famous photograph of eight of them sitting and posing for the cameraman taking their picture. And there's Wyatt, and there's Bat, and there's Luke Short, there's Charlie Bassett, and there's four other guys who were, you know, friends of theirs who had, you know, strapped on guns and said, "Oh, if you need us, we'll be there."
Wyatt Earp lived a pretty long life, didn't he?
He did. As I mentioned, he didn't have a long life as a lawman, because after the events were finally concluded that involved Tombstone and the gunfight, the OK Corral, and its aftermath and its consequences, he really had no interest in being a lawman anymore. He did not apply for any jobs that I can recall. He briefly served as a constable somewhere, but he wanted to make money. You know, being a lawman, you don't make money. There's no pension plan. You know, there's no 401k for frontier lawmen. So he really spent the rest of his life, mostly accompanied by his fourth wife, traveling, looking for the boom towns, looking for the gold strikes, the silver mine strikes, the operating saloons. He was a real estate speculator in San Diego. He was all over the map. He went up to Alaska to run a saloon there because he wanted to make wealth. Always eluded him, but he did in his very last years. He and his wife lived in Los Angeles. He was making a few extra dollars as a consultant to a young director of silent westerns at the time named John Ford. And when Wyatt died, he was a couple months shy of his 81st birthday, and he died in Los Angeles. And that, for the typical lifespan of that time, to die at almost 81 in 1929 was really a long life. And in his last years, he did, you know, keep refusing to do his autobiography or biography, because he didn't want to officially sanction a lot of the myths and untrue and embellished stories that have been passed around about him for decades.
Bat Masterson lived a long life too, right? In what year did he die?
1921. He did, and he spent the last 15 years of his life, he lived in New York City as a New York City newspaper reporter and columnist. His column was the most popular one in New York City. People, you know, it was three times a week, and he would write about the three favorite topics that he enjoyed that began with the letter B. Baseball, boxing, and Broadway. He would go to plays, he'd go to boxing matches, he'd go to baseball games. He'd write about them in his column, and people, the morning his column came out, people rushed to get the newspaper because he was such an entertaining writer. And he enjoyed his life immensely. He'd gotten married, but he only had the one wife, and they had been married for over 30 years. It was a very enjoyable life. He, at the newspaper, the New York World Telegram, his protege there was a fellow, a young reporter named Damon Runyon. And Runyon idolized Bat and thought he was a wonderful, wonderful man and writer. And in fact, he was a pallbearer at Bat's funeral. And some years afterwards, Runyon wrote a collection of stories about New York in the 1910s and 20s. And he named his main character was named Sky Masterson, which he did to honor Bat Masterson. And those stories were later turned into the great Broadway show Guys and Dolls.
Oh, cool. Actually, in a past episode, we talked about Damon Runyon and his relationship with gambler and fixer Arnold Rothstein.
Yes. Yeah, Bat knew a lot of the gamblers at the time, because they would all go to the same saloons. And Bat was a legendary figure, so even the gangsters looked up to Bat.
Oh, really? Do you know whether Earp and Masterson corresponded in their twilight years?
It doesn't seem like it. You know, it's possible that Bat may have written Wyatt, because, like I say, Bat liked to write. He liked to write letters. I didn't find any evidence to show that Wyatt was a letter writer. And in those days, you know, you couldn't just pick up the phone and make, because they were living on different coasts too. you know, Wyatt, the last decade or so of his life, he was strictly a West Coast guy, and Bat, the last 15 years of his life, was strictly a New York City guy. So I don't even know if they had phones. You know, I mean, civilization had phones, of course, but I don't know if they personally had phones. I'm sure Bat had access to a phone at the newspaper office. So I couldn't find anything to indicate that, even though Bat would write in his later years, he still considered Wyatt his best friend, that they continued to have any contact in their golden years.
So I've got to ask you about your newest book, available in bookstores and online, right?
Sure.
Along with Dodge City and your other books, of course, too.
Yeah, there's Dodge City, which we've been talking about, came out in paperback this spring, so that's available. And I have a book that just got published called Being Ted Williams, which is a book that I did with the late broadcaster Dick Enberg. You know, he unfortunately passed away right as we were finishing the book, and it's about Dick's long friendship with Ted Williams, and Ted Williams being his baseball hero, and it's got, you know, some good stories in there about the Ted Williams that you don't know. And and my next book with Bob Drury, you know, he'd done The Heart of Everything That Is together. My next book with him will be coming out in October, and it's got the very simple title of Valley Forge. And not surprisingly, the book's about that six-month encampment during the Revolutionary War that our contention is that saved the American Revolution. If the Continental Army had not survived the Valley Forge encampment, there would not have been American independence, at least at that time.
You're a writing machine.
I don't know how to do anything else. I have no other talents. So I might as well keep doing the one thing I know how to do.
I doubt that very much. Well, this has been great. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your questions and your time.
Again, my guest has been Tom Clavin, New York Times bestselling author of Dodge City, Wyatt Earp, Bat Masterson, and The Wickedest Town in the American West. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you ever wondered how inbred the Habsburgs really were? What women in the past used for birth control? Or what Queen Victoria's 9 children got up to? On the History Tea Time podcast, I profile remarkable queens and LGBTQ+ royals, explore royal family trees, and delve into women's medical history and other fascinating topics. Join me every Tuesday for History Tea Time, wherever fine podcasts are enjoyed.